Strap in, weaklings. It's weekly o'clock. 2:20 in your face. That's Chris. I'm Jeremy. Let's do this.
I was not prepared for that.
I've been reading too much 90s steam or diesel funk.
All right. So you got to do it again next week.
I'll do it again. I was missing the intensity, you know, the X of everything that we had in the 90s. Everything was extreme and in your face.
Yeah, well, okay, triple X, right?
Right. Yeah, yeah. And I noticed that with the writing, too. It's funny, you know, how, like, you know, it's trying to capture that the tone, like a 90s
tone. Is it trying to capture the tone, or what? Because when was it written?
Oh, it was written in the 90s. Hey, yeah,
oh, there
so,
you go.
Yeah,
okay.
So, yeah, I mean, maybe that's how everyone was writing.
It's some of it is probably, this is just how it was written, but do you think it was also trying to, like, grab the zeitgeist of whatever 90s?
I don't know. I wonder. Yeah, I wonder if because the game, you know, the Mutant Chronicles and everything already has that kind of built in, so it's easy to lean into that. So I wonder. But yeah, that's definitely infectious. How you talk about everything. All right. So this week on the weekly, making of D&D book.
Okay.
Shin Megami Tensei, RPG in English.
Okay.
Artists leaving Games Workshop.
Okay.
It's too late for Cool Stuff, Inc. And a last minute add, MCDM RPG.
Okay.
Let's see how we do in this extreme version.
Yeah. We need to replace, like, the K weekly with a giant scrawled X.
Yeah, right. Yes, need that very chromey metal. So we'll start with an interesting historical book actually being released by Wizards of the Coast as maybe part of the anniversary thing. So there have been several books about Arneson and Gygax.
Yep.
That relationship, Game Wizards. There's even a bit in Slaying the Dragon. There's been quite a few books, you know, kind of doing either interviews or going through old archival. Yeah. Yeah. Letters and written in archival.
How long until someone just digs up a grave and starts reading through the skeleton?
Right. I don't know. They were working up to it, I guess. So the making of original Dungeons and Dragons, 1970 to 1976, is a 500-page book that Wizards of the Coast is releasing sometime next year. They kind of tipped their hand, but then maybe not. This was revealed at PAX Unplugged in 2023's panel.
Mad that PAX Unplugged happens in my home city.
Oh, and I'm just serious? Oh, that sucks. Yeah. Especially nothing better than a local convention. Yeah. It's pretty good. So there was a panel. Jeremy Crawford, Chris Perkins, Amanda Hammond, and James Wyatt were going over the D&D 2024 core book details, upcoming adventure supplements, and then they revealed this. Uh-huh. And so it's going to be basically a collection of artifacts. Okay. And they got John Peterson, who wrote Game Wizards and Playing at the World, and is a really good archivist, real good historian of tabletop and wargaming, to help them put this together. He also worked on their art book, the D&D art book that they did, which has a lot of nice original stuff in it. So it'll be a retrospective of a historical account of the original D&D, original illustrations, notations from the original manuscripts, a replica of the original D&D manual, complete with footnotes, edit lines, and original scans whenever possible. So, yeah, this is interesting. Oh, yeah, Elusive Shift as well. So Playing at the World, Elusive Shift, and the Art and Arcana Dungeons and Dragons book he's been involved with. So, yeah, this will be an interesting thing, and it's strange because this is a little bit contentious. You know, like, you know, Gygax, you know, kind of took over, and his name ended up on everything, and Wizards is going to kind of reopen this. I think there's still living relatives and stuff that are might have a problem if, depending on how this book paints the people. But I guess if it's coming from correspondence, yeah, we'll see. So correspondence, they're claiming correspondence that has never been seen by public. Uh-huh. So it'll be, you know, basically the origins of Arneson's homebrew Blackmoor and Gygax's Greyhawk.
Right.
So yeah, we'll see. And this is, of course, we've got the documentary coming up. They didn't promote that though, but the Untitled D&D documentary with Joe Manganiello is still coming. But a funny thing that happened when they were revealing this is they were posting on social media. They posted on Instagram, and the graphics that they used had release dates for everything coming out next year.
Whoa.
So they released them and then immediately took them down.
Right. Not before someone screencapped them.
Of course, yes. The internet never forgets. Yep. And so the release will be in late May for the new stuff coming up. So that means the core books, core rule books for the 2024, whatever they're calling it, And along with Vecna, Eve of Ruin campaign, which is their adventure campaign. And then in June following will be the making of original D&D book. And then Quest from the Infinite Staircase in July. So summer releases. Everything, we have a busy summer with D&D releases, but that may not
will
hold.
Will we have a busy summer? we
won't.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah,
some people will.
Yeah, some okay, people there you go. The some world. People will, yeah.
Yes. So, yeah, that was funny. So they showed that, and then they're like, oh wait, those aren't set, you know, set in stone yet. So let's take that back. Mm. So because they've had a lot of production problems, you know, the Deck of Many Things was a big failure as far as producing something that wasn't garbage
for a garbage card. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And so yeah, you know, global distribution, everything is getting harder. It's much more unpredictable. So showing this date was maybe a bit of a whoopsie.
I mean, to cut them a little bit of slack, like. A release date doesn't necessarily mean worldwide.
Right. Yeah, so next year, things are going to get weird next year. We'll see how that goes. And this will be, I mean, this is really big for them. And if they botch this, then I think D&D is going to, you know, if they...
Oh, you're not talking solely about...
If these releases and nobody can log into the VTT and people are just like, wait, I can't, what's going on? I mean, if you start to make it difficult to have access to your game, or if, you know, people start, you know, being suspicious of quality, there's so much else out there of high quality, well edited, well made, and without AI art.
Not D&D, though.
Yeah, right. Sorry.
Like that.
Yeah,
like,
no, yeah.
Okay, true. I agree that if WotC and Hasbro have trouble rolling the stuff out next year, yes, they will lose some people. At this point, D&D has become a lifestyle brand, right?
Right. Yeah, just gotta,
like,
yeah.
Sure, there are people that play it that are not devotees, but it's a lifestyle brand, which is why we have all this stuff around it. The hardcore fans, you're not going to lose them, right? They're going to be like, oh, well, just, you know, wait for the quality, right? Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So it'll be an interesting year. I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about. We can be disappointed continually.
That was this year.
Oh, that's right.
That was this year. God damn it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I still can't believe this is still the same year that the OGL debacle happened.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeez. And people have already forgotten. They're looking forward to the release.
And like, I was just talking about that on social media this morning. Mm-hmm. And the fact that there was this big stink about, oh, they're just trying to screw me. And then like, as soon as Wizards walked it back and went, we're cool.
Yeah, they're nice guys.
Yeah, I mean, it's that lifestyle brand, hardcore, drunk the Kool-Aid. That's what I said. Yeah. Unless the rollout is just a complete and total flop, they're not going to lose the hardcore fans.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny. But something to look forward to.
Ask me how I really feel.
And something else that kind of slipped out, maybe accidentally, but it was... interesting. There was an Amazon posting of a Shin Megami Tensei role-playing game in English.
Okay.
So Tokyo Conception. So otherwise known, I think the North American name, they changed it to Persona, so it didn't have the long Japanese name yet. So the Persona series has had a TTRPG since 1993 in Japan. Yeah, so it's had numerous editions and revisions over the years, but it's never been released in English. Probably some fan translations, but never been released in English. So neither Sega or Atlas or even the Rulebooks publisher has announced anything about this, but it just showed up for $50 on Amazon
to be
released February 20th, 2024. So Lion Wing Publishing was the listed publisher, and they've previously done games like Embryo Engine, Gun and Gun, and Convictor Drive. So they kind of specialize in localizing for English-speaking markets, Japanese tabletop. And so we don't know. There aren't details like in the description whether this is going to include the Mala Underground expansion. Basically, the game concept and everything is based on Shin Megami Tensei 3. So whatever the first two things did, they are ignoring that. So Nocturne, one of the more popular ones in the early days, that launched in 2004, September in Japan. So this is old stuff.
Yeah.
And the game in Japan is already in its fifth edition.
Yeah,
So we're finally getting, after five editions, finally getting an English version of it.
Okay, not a video game player. I know people talk about Persona. I have no idea if, like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Like, I have to think it's kind of like Final Fantasy, where it's like, elements are the same.
Mm-hmm.
Not maybe a continuation of the storyline, not necessarily the same character, storyline, whatever, but similar through lines. Just rather than, like, 5th edition.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and it's, so Demons and High School in Tokyo. So
how could that go wrong?
Yeah, that's got to be good. So they don't say anything about the system or anything. So yeah, we'll see what that looks like. And finally, all that fan translation maybe got put to good use. Who knows? All right. An interesting. So Spiky Bits really loves bagging on Games Workshop, and they're fun articles to read. So I keep reading them.
So they're doing something right.
So their art department is just abandoning ship. So
really?
Yeah, Games Workshop is losing artists at an alarming rate. So we already saw the creators and kind of their you know, people in front of the camera, like Duncan Peachy and Louise Sugden, leaving and starting their own channels and probably making more money than they did at Games Workshop, just running social media and YouTube. But this year, they've also lost Paul Dayton, Phil Moss, and Thomas Elliott. So Dayton was illustrating for over 20 years for Games Workshop. And the thing is, I'm glad people even know the names. I mean, you know the names of the employees, but I can't, when I hear those names, I can't connect it to the art.
Not the way you can connect it to like John Blanche.
Right. Yeah. So they're not being supported. And maybe that's part of the reason to leave is because other companies will put your name on it and say art by, and you're going to help, you know, people will connect your style with your name. And that's just not happening at Games Workshop. So Dayton is moving to Come On. So it's going to be the senior artist, or started as a senior artist already this year. And so contributing his work to Command's, and unfortunately they have so many licensed licensed products. I hope he's not going to be drawing the X-Men, but anyhow, he was basically the director of all of the art. So probably everything for 10th edition has already been done, and his you know work and his art direction is going to be all over that, along with Age of Sigmar. So that's pretty big. So he left back in August, and then Thomas Elliott joins Archvillain, so Archvillain Games. And then Phil Moss was an 8-year veteran and created some of the covers for the 40K rulebooks and is gone. Mm. So yeah, interesting. So I wonder what is causing that. And if it is like, you know, recognition or if it's compensation. I mean, this is a company that's easily doing better. Games Workshop is doing better than any other tabletop company, and they're not paying people well enough to keep them. Nottingham is a terrible place to work. I don't know.
I have to think you'd be able to do it remote.
Yeah. That's true.
Maybe not. Not the way Games Workshop works, right?
Yeah.
But not going to speculate what goes on behind closed doors at Games Workshop, but I am, right? Like you said, it might be compensation. It might be just, okay, I've done this a lot, and you're not putting my name.
Right, no recognition. Right? Yeah.
If inside the book it says, like, art by Games Workshop Studio.
Oh, yeah.
You're just like...
Yeah, just like they do the Story Forge, you know, the people that wrote their animation.
I have to think it's that that writing, you know, Story Forge, is why would a company who does that...
Mm-hmm.
Do that? Why would a company who does that? Did I mention I'm an English teacher? Why would a company who does that?
Who do that?
Thank you. Why would a company who do that? God damn it. I'm going to be stuck on that for a while. Okay. Not do that kind of across the board.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and that's true. And the frightening thing is, you know, if these artists have already been working for a decade or more with them, they have a lot of examples of their art. There's software you can feed their art into and recreate. So
I wasn't going to bring that up, but yeah, I mean,
that's the scary thing is like, if you're unhappy in your creative position with a company like that, we're like, well, we can save even more money because we already have several examples of your style can reverse engineer.
On the speculation train, who's to say GW is not already doing that?
Yeah, though that's true too. And that might be part of the, and that, you know, you're just not allowed, your contract or whatever doesn't allow you. There's an NDA that doesn't allow you to say anything about what's going on.
Yeah.
In workings.
I don't know. I don't like it, but at the same time, I don't know what the contract these artists had with Games Workshop was. If it was something like, cool, you now own my artwork, then Games Workshop has the right to feed it into an AI machine, right?
Yeah, that's
unless
true.
That was part of the clause in the contract, right?
No, that's true. And if it's all digital, ouch. But more bad news. There's always related articles on the site. Their live engagement for a lot of the Games Workshop live streams, their reveals and stuff is just declining. It's on like kind of a steady decline. Mm. They were getting pretty decent numbers. Almost 30,000 viewers for when they do big launches. to reveal things or big events. And they've lost almost 10,000 viewers totally for their compared to last year's grand narrative streams. And I really don't think they do streams very well.
Okay.
They either do people in webcams, which might be something from the pandemic, people right. at home. So people in lousy webcams with bad microphones, or they have like a sports commentator desk with two guys sitting there, with the little golf shirts on with the logos, and you're just like, okay, yeah. So they're not great. What they
maybe
do?
Maybe that's why then.
So
I also don't know how often they do them.
Right, right. And the scheduling is very weird. I'm sure the UK viewers are very happy, but it's, pretty inconvenient to see anything. But, so we'll see. We'll see how if people are actually starting to be less interested in this as they're stepping up, because they've invested a lot, it seems like, in infrastructure. They rebuilt their website. They've got warehouses with robots and whatever kind of nonsense is going on.
Why would you not have, Skullface Server?
Right.
Missed opportunity there. If you're going to squander money, that's the place to do it, right?
Right. Yeah, well, that's where they artists, all the former employees' skulls will still be used. So yeah, we'll see if they can maintain, because 10th edition should have been huge. It should have been. It should have been a big celebration, and it just wasn't. So
maybe customers got tired of having to spend so much money.
Yeah, right.
Big celebration of where you got to rebuild your army from scratch. Oh,
yes.
Right? I don't know. I have not played 40K and not been in the 40K playing scene for so long, I kind of can't comment at all on rules, right? Model side and stuff like that, okay, I can comment on, but the rules wise, I don't know.
Yes, so
the only thing I will say, whatever editor they had for Rick Priestley when he was writing the rules, fucking golden, because the rule sets he right now, my God, right? They are.
Somebody's gonna show up at your door and just stab you and say, Rick Priestley says hello.
I'm sure the rules are great, but after reading Black Powder Second Edition, it's the classic. Here's a whole page on how the table should be arranged and all this stuff, and you can spend an enjoyable evening or afternoon with other people. Just tell me it's a fucking 4x6 table, bro. Right? That's all I needed to know.
Right.
Anyway, yeah. Moving on.
Well, here's a little bit of the blame game. Ooh, so, okay. Cool Stuff Inc.'s founder says it's too late for us.
Oh.
So they're putting the blame on, they're pointing the finger at Amazon. So Cool Stuff Inc. used to be one of the world's largest online board game retailers, and they didn't start out as having any interest in board games. They were originally a CCG seller, singles for Magic and I'm sure cases and stuff. Their biggest competitor at that time, so they were founded in 2002, so they've been around for a while. Yeah. This is after the bubble, they got themselves set up when things were just kind of recovering. And their biggest competitors were things like Card House, and they noticed that Card House was having some success selling Settlers of Catan, of course.
Best board game in the world.
Many dozens of copies a week. So they decided to get into it. It was slow at first, but they built this up to do a pretty swift business, but there were thousands of board games coming out a year at the kind of the peak of things. And so there was a ton. And then things just, the board game market started to cool down. Yeah, and I think a lot of customers moved to crowdfunding. You moved to getting things directly. Yeah. And there wasn't much left for people that were going to handle. So they were having trouble with distribution. But the founder is saying that the real trouble happened for them, and I'm not sure this is his side of the story. 2013, Amazon hired a product manager for board games that specifically targeted the online competition. So originally, Cool Stuff was using an Amazon marketplace and sharing their inventory and selling stuff on Amazon. And then when this thing happened, it was a shift, and suddenly they were competing directly with Amazon, and Amazon's prices were always better.
Right.
Their shipping was always better, and they just couldn't happen. Then a couple other factors kind of converged. Minimum advertised price was implemented that stopped them from selling through distribution, and then Kickstarter. Yeah, Kickstarter took a big bite out of them. But they're saying that Amazon directly targeted them. And the way that they know this is that they would change their prices to odd little random prices.
Okay.
And Amazon then would have stuff listed for that exact same price. So that was, for them, proof that Amazon was, like, specifically trying to destroy them. Yeah. And so they started to try to diversify. They started a thing, Quartermaster Logistics. They partnered with Tom Vassell and Dice Tower. And we're doing, direct fulfillment and things, and working with, they brought in people from Fun Again, which I think does fulfillment and things, or did, with board games. And now Fun Again is out of business, and they don't feel like board games are their future. So they're just kind of stepping away. Oh. They're going to stick with the cards. They're probably much easier to warehouse.
Yeah.
And another thing that they point to is Amazon is being sued. There's the FTC claims of monopolistic practices. So there's a bunch of charges against them in several states in the U.S. So it's going to be a financial penalty that Amazon made in the time that it takes to read the judgment. Amazon would have made the money to pay for that. So it's like, okay, you're going to have to do something else other than fine them. But it was kind of a really sad sad story about the decline of this and how, you know, we just can't do this anymore. But the comment section under this post got really contentious.
Okay.
A lot of people are pointing to your business practices sucked. The quality, you didn't know how to do shipping. You didn't handle things well. It's not all Amazon's fault. You know, Amazon automates so much stuff. So if it's following your pricing, that could just be the algorithm. That could just be a bot. You know, that could be something crawling.
Okay, like, I'm not saying they're wrong. The thing is, it's the algorithm. Like, someone wrote that. That doesn't. Right. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. So they just said they made bad business decisions. Don't blame Amazon. So I was surprised Amazon was getting so many defenders. Maybe.
Well, Amazon's a lifestyle brand too, right?
Yeah,
right. People will go to bat for their company.
Right? That's true. Yeah, complaining about the customer service. So just going on. And they're saying that, you know, Amazon really didn't do anything that was non-competitive to you. It's just they are better at doing, they can move faster and bigger and better at doing things. And yeah, you just can't keep up with that. You do have to niche, specialize, do something that they're not doing and they're not even interested in.
And you know what? It is possible both things happened.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that's true. No, it's possibly a combination of both. Yes. So, I'm sorry, I missed his name. Jerry Solkind. They're stepping back, and it kind of the end of an era for, I think, a lot of the online retail is going to kind of, it's kind of shrinking, and you need the support of maybe a lot of social media support and a lot of influencer support to keep sales coming in. Because, you know, when you're discounting things and cutting your profit margin so slim compared to, you know, now Games Workshop wants you order directly from them. Yeah. So they get the full, you know, full retail price for everything. It's hard. It's hard to compete. But but people are saying it's not all Amazon's fault. You know, their market changes and
not going to bet for Amazon.
Your business practices, so on and so forth. All right. And a last minute addition, a Kickstarter, the MCDM Productions. Yes. Oh, yes. So they're raising money and they've already raised a shitload of money.
Like, that's an actual number, shitload, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes, that is the amount that they seem to consistently raise. So we've already had Kobold Press did Tales of the Valiant, their Black Flag project. Mm-hmm. Now Matt Colville is stepping in, and it seems a little late in the game, but I think the timing might work because the dust is kind of settled. And what they're doing is, so what he did with MCDM was basically do third-party support for 5e. Okay. They did so many releases, very successful Kickstarters, you know, gorgeous art, things that people really liked. You may have remembered, like, Strongholds and Followers, Kingdoms and Warfare, Where Evil Lives, and Flea Mortals were some of their releases. These were all multi-million dollar, not all of them, but they made $2.1 million for Strongholds and Followers, $1.4 million for Kingdoms and Warfare.
$2 million, I mean, it's fair.
Yeah, okay. $2 million. And Flea Mortals, which was kind of just an expanded monster manual, $2 million. Mm-hmm. So they consistently do well on social media. And Colville has a connection with the Critters. So Critical Role, he's been writing the comics for Dark Horse Comics. So he's been connected with them for a while. And then some of his staff for MCDM also helped with the putting together the book, the source book that they did for the Critical Role setting. So they have some connections that I'm sure that probably helps. So they have friendly names and faces and things.
A built-in rabid fan base.
And they already, you know, have had so much success with crowdfunding that this seems like a logical move. So they're doing their own system. they already have their, you know, they already have developed settings and they already have monsters and a lot of mechanics and things that they've developed that kind of, you know, are add on to 5e. Now they're stepping away and doing their own system. They're going to have their own gaming license. And it sounds interesting. There's a couple of things that turn me off and it doesn't seem like something.
A gaming license because you don't need one. Right? Anyway.
Well, yeah. It doesn't, it seems like that, you know, they're very 4e. And Coville comes from video games. So a lot of the approach sounds a little bit like video games. Their playtesting and everything sounds a lot more video gamey. But the designer that one of the designers said, we're encapsulating decades of design experience into crafting an RPG experience that focuses on the hero's journey filled with action and strategic combat. Characters don't just swing their swords. Monsters aren't just bags of hit points. Every hero and monster turn is dynamic and full of cinematic action. So that's the
sounds
thing
like a lot of crap to track.
Yeah, right. That's
sorry.
Yeah, there's a lot. Yeah, it sounds like the character classes have a lot of points. So they are focusing on the cinematic as opposed to the simulationist. They're moving away from that, which I guess, yeah, was what early versions and even, I guess, 4E had a bit of simulation.
I don't know if you can say simulation. Like, as soon as you, sorry. Oh, yeah. As soon as you toss magic into anything, simulation is just out the fucking door. Right. Okay. I disagree because I've gotten into friendly arguments with people, right? Simulationist, in my opinion, or what one definition of simulationist is, we have this world, we're going to try and simulate the physics of this world, right? And if the world includes magic, well, we're going to try and simulate what magic works, right, as opposed to like emulating a genre or cinematic might be, that might be a genre, right? So, okay, yes. Simulationist does not mean the real world. Simulationist means there are these physical rules and we're going to try and replicate them in mechanic form.
Right. So they for this system, they are abandoning the D20.
I'm already interested. Okay.
Yeah, so you're rolling two D6s and you're adding a D8 or a D4 or some other kind of bonus die to the roll. And these are just so they represent, you know, situational advantages, disadvantages. And an interesting thing, so there's a 50-minute crowdfunding video for this. And this is available on BackerKit. It's not it's not a Kickstarter, if I've accidentally said that. It's a crowdfunder on BackerKit. And a 50-minute video that outlines everything. And the interesting thing is there's no two-hit rolls. You always hit. It's just how much how successful your hit is. So both sides are always hitting, and it just, you know, you just want to get as big. You just want to kind of, you know, build up your attacks. So the, you know, cooperation between the party members helps to, you know, get those big combos, lay in some big attacks. So that's interesting. You're not, because that's the weird thing about when you're playing kind of OSR. It's like miss. A whole round of miss. Okay, one more time. Miss. And there's no way to do that. Sure. So, yeah, they're avoiding that. The one thing where I start to go, okay, and step back a little bit is the game master is called the director. Okay, and they're...
I don't immediately hate it, but okay.
Because they're focusing on the cinematic. Mm-hmm. So the directors are... Okay, so the interesting thing, the whoever wins initiative, they get to... elect the person that goes, or, you know, the player character goes, and then they elect who on the other side, the losing side, goes.
So it's something I think this is called like popcorn initiative or something like that.
Yes, yeah, right,
like,
right.
I took my turn, and I get to choose who goes.
Yeah,
first.
Right, right.
Maybe it has to be someone on the other side.
Yeah,
right?
And try to either knock them out of order or do some the weaker. Yeah,
I like it. There's tactics there.
Yeah,
not tactics, but strategy. Right. Okay.
But this is when I was like, oh, okay. Directors are also encouraged to yell cut when, combat is starting to slog So you're just ending cut to make it cinematic. So avoiding things just dragging on too long.
You know what? Okay. My face said I don't like them, but.
But in your heart.
Okay. I'm going to, similar to the way the Apocalypse World Engine kind of wrote out and, in my opinion, codified things that good GMs were already doing and turned them into GM moves, which a lot of people have trouble with. Like, knowing when to end the scene is a GM skill. No, we got to move on, right?
Right.
So my initial knee-jerk reaction was, but then I'm like, no, good GMs do that in any way.
Yeah.
Unless there's some kind of like weird mechanic or whatever tied to it, then I'm actually okay with this.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, no, that does make sense, and especially the, because if you're talking about cinematic, like framing it in scenes from a movie and stuff helps everyone to kind of understand, you know, what you're dealing with instead of just I don't know, we're wandering around and or just the endless exchanging blows.
Oh, there are still enemies up and moving, right?
Right. Yeah, yes, yeah. Right. So, a lot of things have been carried over from the development they've been doing for 5e. So, Flea Mortals included controllers and minions, which may be something they do with their necromancer classes or things.
Yeah, I think controllers were able to like move stuff around the battlefield, and minions were like, hey, there's a whole bunch of these little monsters that kind of, you know. Yeah, I think they had like one hit each, but it's a way to represent like giant mobs.
Oh, right. Oh, that's right, because they did this. Yeah, they did siege, kind of siege mechanics and stuff. Right. So instantly they got $1 million. So their goal was their goal was 800,000. And then they said this is their highest goal ever. And what's good is BackerKit is not going to take a big bite out of it. Sure. So they're going to get most of this money, but they have pretty ambitious stretch goals. So 1.5 million and 2 million are their two goals, and I think they're both already achieved. One of them will get you a virtual tabletop specific for this game. They're developing their own VTT for this game, and it's like, okay, they said though this is not a guarantee. You're not, you know, pledging to get this virtual tabletop, but they've already hired somebody. They showed screenshots of what they've been developing. They've already played in it, like doing some testing. Mm-hmm. So it's in process. They already have a third party working on this. So they said, at that stretch goal, we will, you know, make this go forward. But because they do come from video games, they understand this could just fall apart. This could get too expensive. Okay. It could not work. But they're doing their own VTT. And also the I think it's 1.5 million is going to give you multiple settings. They've got like in their fantasy world, which they've already kind of established. You'll have a fantasy kind of exploration setting, a city-based kind of urban setting, and then a, you know, time travel kind of weird 70s sci-fi kind of setting. So they're also being very honest about the pricing. Mm-hmm. So $40 will get you so the books that they're releasing, they're doing two books, a heroes book, which is all the rules for character creation, mm-hmm. heroes, how everything works, leveling up, and then a monsters book. And you can't get the monsters book by itself because it's kind of goes with the hero book, but the hero book is the rule book. And they said they're not doing any director's guides or anything.
Okay.
The way that they've already approached it is they have been, you know, releasing updates. I forget what they're calling them, but these little PDF updates that give you instructions about how to play the game. The rules to play the game are in the player's guide. So the running the game is kind of already in their YouTube videos, and you know, because they've been developing for a while. So, and I think the list of you know, spells and then also magic items are in the player's guide. So
they gotta bulk that book out.
Yeah, right. So they don't see any reason. And in the monster's guide will be, you know, how to kind of play the monsters and, you know, where they go and more about the setting. But then they're going to be releasing, you know, how to play the settings is going to be in the settings books. And they're going to do, if they get higher, and I think the next highest stretch goal or their kind of idea is their settings will be box sets eventually. Not maybe with this campaign, but if this is successful, they'll keep supporting this. And the structure of the playtesting was kind of interesting. They've been doing internal testing for a while. They have a Patreon, so they let people kind of see what they're doing. So you get to see the real ugly and scratched out, well, we're not doing this, this is gone, parts of it. Once that's completed, they're hiring paid playtesters. They're going to go outside and give these guys the game and just have them, just like a video game, you get the testers that are just going to tear it apart and find out every way to break it and then give you back that data. Then patrons on the Patreon will be kind of their first round of beta testers after that's been all ironed out. So it's going to be a while. They're not expecting to have finished this before maybe June of 2025.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So they're giving it plenty of time. You can have an early PDF. They say fairly early. You'll have some sort of, you know, quick start to try it out. And then early versions of PDF will come out probably next year. But they don't want to promise a finished anything until that 2025 date. Okay. It's going to be expensive. The books themselves will be $70 each. The set, I think, is $130. And then there's, of course, a limited edition version and more and more expensive versions, right?
Ribbon bookmarks.
Yes, and adding stuff because they, you know, everybody likes that cool stuff, and they are,
or they suffer from FOMO,
right? And
which I'm not immune to. So yeah. Okay.
And in the, I'm sorry. So with the stretch goals and the success of the campaign, Coville talked about time. So if you want this sooner, if we get more money, it will be done sooner. we can buy time because we will hire more contractors. We'll hire more artists. We'll hire more people. So we'll have a bigger team. We'll build the team. If this is really well funded, our team will grow and the we'll actually be able to complete it sooner. So they can't speed up playtesting, but they can speed up the production, you know, layout and everything if they have more people on it. So I thought that was a very interesting way to put it.
It is. And I guess it's kind of honest, right? The more money we get, the faster we can produce this because, yeah, the bigger the team. Okay.
Yeah. So the game itself doesn't sound... It's interesting because it sounds like Colville is part of like this next generation of like, you know, the default reliable game designers that people are going to say, oh, they always do good stuff and I follow whatever they do, kind of like the other ones. It's like a next generation. And so this is interesting. If this gets a foothold and people really like it, sounds like it. You can do a little bit too much min-maxing and a lot of... I don't know. And there are a lot of points. Each class has different points. And they rename kind of all the classes to, instead of rogue or thief, it's the shadow. And instead of... Yeah, so it's kind of like they're generalizing them. And maybe that makes them more portable to different settings, you know, when they're not, when they don't sound so...
Or the alternative is just, you know what? Similar to Paizo, we're divesting ourselves from any and all WotC and Hasbro IP. And so...
Yeah. Yeah, moving away from D20 and then and renaming classes. Yeah, does mean that, we're not... We don't want to connect ourselves at all to that, just in case.
I haven't picked up any other stuff because I'm not interested in 5e or D20 or like that. But I have to wonder if they have a big enough following where a sizable chunk of people are going to go, yeah, you know what? Let's go play this instead of D&D.
Right.
I wonder what's going to happen. Are we starting to see enough people leave the WotC D&D walled garden?
Almost 2 million.
Okay, yeah.
It's only been 2 days.
Well, I mean, like, it pays to have a big following. Well, and that's not to say that they haven't put out lots of stuff in the past, right? Obviously, their following is kind of well earned with all the stuff they put out. So.
Oh yeah, and I think this is when you cash in. Like, this is when all that goodwill and all the, you know, people appreciating the quality of your work, but it was third party supporting 5e. Mm-hmm. This is when you cash in on that, make it your own thing, because you have no idea what WotC is going to do. It's like, oh yeah, you did this great stuff, but screw you. You know,
well, that's exactly what I said on social media this morning. Yeah, right? Where I was talking about like the OGL, like, cool. Why do you want to tie yourself? Okay. The ORC is a little bit different, right? The kind of being owned by, not owned, but like managed by a separate entity makes me a bit less leery of it. But why do you want to tie yourself to any kind of OGL-like thing? Because all you're doing is setting yourself up for 10, 5, 10, 15 years for that company to go, yeah, no, yoink, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we own this or you don't
first
own
time,
this, you can't
shame
sell
on
this.
You. Yeah. Trick me once, shame on me, right? Fool me twice, shame on you, right? Like, why are you doing this? So, yes.
Yes.
People who... were big into third party, or companies were big into third party D&D stuff.
Yeah, they have to. Yeah, so Cobalt Press and now MCDM are going. Yeah, are going to go. They're going their own way, and they did talk about the reason that they wanted to develop their own license because they want people to be able to. And they've already done a license, I think, for one of their settings or something. But they want people to be able to make money off of supporting them. You know, be able to develop their own third party.
Sure, yeah. I'm leery of what those not leery. Because, like, in the little indie thing, like, there's lots of little licenses, right? Or they're kind of SRDs, or all you have to do is include, like, this little line to say it was kind of built from whatever and you're allowed to sell it. I want to know what kind of the bigger, not quite indie games license looks like.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That will be interesting. A couple of the other encouraging things about this campaign that Colville said is their biggest expense is art.
Okay.
And I was like, oh. Thank God. You know, that's
maybe they're just funneling a lot of stuff into an AI machine.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a really expensive AI. No, but that's really nice to hear that they're actually supporting artists. And they said that, you know, in their personal opinion, they have the best quality art in the business. So that's good. They're still supporting that. They're not like, oh, we can make more money if we kind of back off of that. So they're supporting that. And they're also very honest about, yes, our books are expensive. And, you know, you can wait for them to go to retail. You can just get the PDF. There's ways to not have to spend so much money on them, and definitely just wait until it comes out if you have any reservations or anything, and, you know, hear what people are saying about it, and don't feel like you have to support it right now. But if you support it right now, it's going to be a better product.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
So, yeah. So, that was very honest. A really long video.
Yeah. But, I mean, like, okay, I think honesty is the best policy. Be like, yeah, books are expensive. Here's what it costs us to make them.
Yes. Right? Yeah, right. And that, yeah, discounting it or saying, you know, they're going to give you any sort of break on shipping. He's basically said anybody not in North America is paying an arm and a leg to get this. So, yeah, just you know
someone
that.
Someone who doesn't live in North America and has paid multiple arms and multiple legs for shipping stuff. Yeah, right. Sorry. Shipping is expensive.
It's good they grow back, though. That's the.
But, yeah, otherwise I'd only be able to afford four things. Yeah.
So, yeah, that was interesting. And, yeah, they're going to have success with it because they've done it in the past. And this is their most ambitious, interesting timing, you know, especially, like, the holiday. Like, people are already – they've got a lot of money that they're putting out for, you know, holiday gifts and things and travel and everything. So it might be a little difficult, but this is their last chance before the Watsi machine really gets going. We see what they're capable of doing. Yeah. This is your last chance to say, hey, alternative over here.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Cool.
All right, so that will do it for this week. So where can people find you?
On Blue Sky, or what's the other one? Instagram. It's HiveMind, HYVEMYND, and probably not a lot of updates as I travel.
So this will be our last weekly together, probably until the new year, right?
Well, make sure you add that caveat. This is the last week together. For the new year, right? Until the new year, right? Yeah, I'm coming
so
back.
So see ya. Right. So Chris will be back after the holidays. So I might wrangle Matt in a video window and help me out. But everyone's got holiday plans. So we'll see how our release goes during the holidays, the schedule. But hang in there. And if anyone is bored of their family, come over here. We've got lots of stuff going on. So I'm still doing my single panel gag cartoon, even though last week it didn't happen. But I draw abuse cartoons and two cartoons a week. I do the live stream for that. And you can find that on YouTube and Twitch, as well as gocomics.com/domesticabuse.
For the 20-year archive.
In a 20-year archive, yes. You can read it all Christmas time. And if you like what we're doing here, consider becoming a weakling.
The strongest of all supporters. Didn't miss my cue that time. Yes. The intro messed me up. Yes.
Patreon.com/upturntable. And support us and tell us what you like. You can also become a member on the YouTube channel by clicking that join button below video. And also just listen to the audio for free on any podcast, however you get your podcast. The audio for this full live stream goes onto the RSS feed for Patreon, so a little bit of extra bonus. And the video of just the podcast I've been re-uploading just in case people don't want all the screwing around before and after. It's almost double. Yeah. So upturntable.com and all that good stuff. And we're doing still the nightly readings of a chapter a night of Dementia, the third volume of the Apostle of Insanity trilogy. So if you want to get your Mutant Chronicles Warzone on, that would be how you do it. And I'm deeply affected by the 90s and all this extreme nonsense going on. So find us there. So thanks for joining us, and we'll be back.
I'll be back next year.
Chris will be back next year. I'll be back next week.
Later, mortals.
Goodbye.